and welcome to LawPod. Before we begin, take a moment to think about the last thing you saw in the news or your social media feeds. What comes to mind? Chances are you would have come across something about the ongoing wars, abusive people in impoverished countries, or tyrannical dictatorships. Have you ever seen something like that and wondered, why aren't we trying to stop this? But who is the we that can help? Maybe the local government in that area, or maybe something bigger like the United Nations or even NATO? Bodies like this are supposed to step in during times of strife, aren't they? What's the point of these big names and intimidating words if they don't intervene in conflicts? Today, we'll be investigating exactly that. What is human rights law, international law, and how effective are they really? I'm Victoria, and I'm joined by Nick, and we have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Conal Mallory from the School of Law here at Queen's University Belfast. He's published works focusing on the intersection between human rights law and judicial studies, including emphasis on the application of human rights during conflicts and the extraterritorial application of these same rights. He also holds a research interest in state representations and various forms of diplomatic discourse in human rights. Thank you for joining us today, Conal. Is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners about yourself before we dive in?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm a fan of the podcast, so I'm delighted to be able to contribute and to have this discussion today.
Dr. Mallory, it seems only natural to start by discussing the ruling of the International Court of Justice on the 26th of January. International law has rarely been brought to the attention of the general public to such an extent, and I know many of my friends who are not law students have been following the case very closely. The ICJ ruled that Israel must take action to prevent acts of genocide, and this has been welcomed by South African officials and described as a ruling in favour of humanity. So what I wanted your opinion on is, how optimistic should supporters of this ruling be? Does history suggest that ICJ rulings are generally adhered to? And do they tend to result in some sort of tangible change?
Let's start with a broad picture of this, okay? When you're involving law and legal disputes in armed conflict matters, something has gone profoundly wrong, okay? Politics and diplomacy solves conflict. Law rarely does. Law is a line that is very, very far back. As a result, we have to temper our expectations about what law and legal recourse can actually resolve. For the past 50 years, states have been bringing each other to international tribunals or to human rights courts during times of armed conflict, usually seeking to uphold rights or to seek some type of compensation. Legal decisions have been rendered in cases involving Cyprus and Turkey, in cases involving Georgia and Russia, in cases involving Russia and the Ukraine. They do not bring about the peace, which is what we're looking for, and the preservation of humanity and the return to a state of normalcy. It's politics and it's diplomacy that does that. Now, with that, the question is, how optimistic can we be about the provisional measures judgment that was issued? We have to be realistic about it for two reasons. The first thing is the judgment itself. South Africa asked for 9 provisional measures. And to be clear, these are interim measures, essentially saying to the court, this needs to be done right now to bring a cessation to real profound human suffering. Of those, the court adopted a handful of them. The majority of the ones that they adopted essentially are reiterations of obligations which are upon the Israeli state already under the Genocide Convention. Now, there are two that are really, really quite important. One of which is that it mandates that Israel must take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of humanitarian relief to Gaza. Very, very important. The second is a more practical, mechanical measure, which is that Israel must submit a report to the court within 1 month. What that essentially says is, you have to come back and tell us what you're doing. It keeps the pressure on the Israeli authorities in order to not draw a line under the legal proceedings. The big headline from the decision is that the South Africans didn't get what they ultimately wanted, which is an immediate ceasefire. The court did not pick up on this. And to be frank, it didn't provide a very coherent explanation for why not to do so. And so optimism has to be tempered by the fact that the decision itself will not materially affect the situation in Gaza beyond perhaps the requirement to see humanitarian relief. That's the first problem that we need to be conscious of. There's a second problem, and it's in respect of compliance. ICJ decisions, they are legally binding, but there's no world police force who's going to pop out and enforce these. There isn't somebody who can step in. The UN Security Council can take action where ICJ measures are not complied with. The reality is that that's probably quite unlikely. The ICJ is a body which is complied with more often than not, but this is not a normal case. We have to be realistic that the other states where they have had issues drawn against them in similar circumstances have flat out refused to follow the orders. So Russia ignored a court order to stop invading Ukraine in 2020. The USA has ignored at least two. The most high profile, which was in 1986, when the ICJ ruled that U.S. support for right-wing Nicaraguan rebels, a group called the Contras, was illegal. And the U.S. was ordered to pay reparations. And rather than complying with the judgment, the USA withdrew its compulsory jurisdiction of the court. When that was subsequently pushed to the UN Security Council, the US, sitting on the Security Council, vetoed the relevant resolution. So this is where law and global politics comes head to head. The sum of this is that we have to be realistic. The judgment itself was perhaps never likely to be legally profound in terms of the effects for the day-to-day life of people in Gaza at the moment. But it has pushed the dial forward.
Yeah, thank you. You mentioned that sometimes these rulings are adhered to, but this is by no means a normal case. And that was something I wanted to mention. One thing that is particularly relevant about this case is, although Israel isn't a member of the UNSC, it does have a well-documented relationship with the United States, who obviously is a member of the Security Council. In cases such as this, do you think the respondent having such a powerful ally sets this apart from other cases, and does it change the sort of international pressure that a ruling like this might generally generate for a more isolated country?
Entirely. This is a situation, and we see it at the UN Security Council, where the United States is stepping in to back Israel's military actions. Alongside other Western states, alongside Canada, alongside members of the European Union, they've been very slow, perhaps is a diplomatic way to say, very slow to come round to the idea of a ceasefire. That is something which is so self-evident. That's where we have to view the provisional measures case. The provisional measures case is one method in a cohesive and a comprehensive attempt by other members of the global community to increase pressure on Israel in particular and Israel's allies in order to attempt to bring about a degree of alleviation of the military activities that are taking place. It's a profound legal avenue because they've used the Genocide Convention to get access to the top table, the International Court of Justice, for this. But it's not the only action that's taking place. We've had the General Assembly has adopted multiple resolutions on this so far, calling for immediate humanitarian ceasefires, calling for the release of hostages being held by Hamas, as well as ensuring humanitarian access to Gaza. The most recent one passed with a majority of 153 in favor, 10 against, and 23 abstentions. That's part of the political pressure which is being put on it. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, he invoked his powers under Article 99 of the UN Charter to call for the UN Security Council to order a humanitarian ceasefire. This is not something that UN Secretary Generals like doing. They don't like, in essence, being seen by states to overstep their mark. But he's used his power to do so, urging the council to help avert a humanitarian catastrophe. We've seen the Security Council has on four or five occasions now, have tried to get resolutions which can be adopted by the Americans, by Western allies of Israel, and they've managed to get to the language of urgent and extended humanitarian pauses for the conflict, but they haven't yet reached that aspect of the comprehensive ceasefire, which I think is what the goal is for the Gaza conflict at the moment.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that they didn't achieve getting a ceasefire, and even if it was found that a ceasefire was necessary by the Court of Justice, that, as you said, with the UN Security Council, it may be unlikely that was actually implemented. So do you think there was any more indirect positive impacts that South Africa may have foreseen by bringing the case to the ICJ? If such like direct compliance is unlikely, why do you think countries bring cases to the ICJ? Are there any other reasons?
Yeah, it's a great question. It speaks to strategy and it speaks to international relations in this regard. The first thing that I'll say is that the case that South Africa brought seeking the immediate cessation of hostilities, it actually wasn't speculative. You know, it's something which the ICJ effectively ordered in respect of Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine. It's not something which is completely outside of the parameters of possibility. It could have been complied with had it been ordered. It would have required, the Israeli authorities would have certainly taken stock of it and then ultimately made a decision where to go with it. I think one big line of thinking behind this is the case brought by South Africa was always going to increase pressure on Israel. The news coverage that it projected. You said yourself, in you're speaking with non-lawyers about international law.
Oh, they've been following it very closely.
Very, very close. And there's a great line in Philippe Sands has a book, Lawless World, which talks about the invasion of Iraq. And his line is that during the invasion of Iraq, dinner table discussion would have essentially been, can the UK revive a Security Council resolution from 1991? Really technical international law stuff. It's brought it back into the public domain, into the public consciousness in a big way. And certainly the provisional measures judgment, but the oral representations by South Africa and by the advocates on behalf of South Africa were incredibly powerful. And those representations themselves, speaking of horrific instances where mothers are having to give birth without pain relief in Gaza, really harrowing, harrowing testimonies. These things are not without weight, and so they build political pressure. The key point of this is the political pressure does not only go on Israel. It goes on those states who are standing up for Israel in the international arena. It's really clearly, I don't just mean the Americans. We're talking about Western European states, the United Kingdom, Italy. Now, what I'll say about the ICJ case is it's not done by any stretch of the imagination. The provisional measures were ordered. But in terms of bringing about some type of immediate relief for the Gazan people, that judgment is, we'll see it revisited in less than a month now. We now enter the lengthy litigation phase. There have been four cases brought under the Genocide Convention and heard by the ICJ. The first one, it took 14 years to get to the merits decision of the case. The case brought by Ukraine against Russia, it's taken 16 months for the court to deal with the oral hearings and preliminary objections of the case. And so, We are going to see the ICJ go dormant on this for a while, apart from these periodic checks.
Well, you both alluded to this a little bit, that there's kind of an elephant in the room about global influence in groups like NATO, the UN, and the International Court of Justice. So would you suppose that there are some members in any of those groups that have a bit too much influence and they may intentionally or unintentionally lead the conversation a bit more than they should?
So we're talking about different organizations here. NATO is a security pact where there are different military contributions being made across the NATO membership. And so larger states and larger military states and that perhaps they necessarily lead the discussion on it. The judges on the ICJ are elected through the General Assembly. You will have big, powerful states will almost always have a judge on the court. There's an element of politics going on in the background, principally because of how they are promoted. The one that really matters is the UN Security Council, the 15 members of the UN Security Council. And this isn't that these members are unintentionally leading discussion. This is entirely intentional. The permanent five members of the UN Security Council are the five states who probably had the greatest importance in the aftermath of the Second World War when the United Nations was founded. And there has been a growing disparity between the strength of some of those states and other states around the world in respect of military might, in respect of economy, in respect of political capital, in respect of population size. We clearly see that the Western bloc in the Security Council is led by the United States, and it will frequently veto things that it doesn't like. Very similar, we see the Eastern bloc or the Russian bloc, which will also veto things that it doesn't like as well. Now, the question is, how do you resolve it? And that's a question which has been part of ongoing discourse in the United Nations for decades now. Probably the most compelling attempt to reform the Security Council under the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who proposed a whole idea about restructuring and ultimately built two different proposals for how the Security Council would look. And it went no further than that. The dialogue and the discourse continues. We have, at the moment, just as with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, just as with the UK-US invasion of Iraq, the Security Council is hemorrhaging legitimacy. And legitimacy is a capital. It rises and it falls. It's hemorrhaging legitimacy. And it's going to come back to, we will go through a period where we come back to questions where you say, how on earth do we not have an African permanent member? How on earth do we not have a South American member of the, a permanent member of the Security Council? How can you have India, the second most populous state in the world, not being represented, or at least somebody from the sub-Indian continent? These institutions are wholly imperfect. And they contribute sometimes to some of the problems in the world, as well as being the principal recourse to fixing the problems. The difficulty is bringing about change in them is not fast.
Do you think there will ever be a point when any measures are put in place to curb any of the powers of the big groups, like the Big Five in the Security Council? Or do you think it'll always be kind of unbalanced because it's inherently part of the structure?
The structure favors consolidation of power in the hands of a few states who were powerful in the late 1940s. Now, without hesitation, we look at China and the United States, and they are the world superpowers. It's very, very difficult to talk about change whenever one of the permanent five members is illegally invading and occupying another another state, one of its neighbors, at this very moment. It's very, very tough. And any mechanisms to attempt to change the permanent five or even the 15 at the Security Council sometimes get met with cynicism by other states who think, well, you're trying to make it worse.
Do you think, regardless of whatever countries are added or whatever reforms are made, like the ones you suggested, that international law and equality before international law will always be, to some extent, subservient to global politics?
Yeah. It just goes back to that imperfect nature. States will often act in their own interests. And that's, you know, international relations theorists have dealt with this for years. I think what we have to remember as well is that states are speaking globally, and yet they're also turning the other way, and they are political representatives who are speaking domestically. And it's a difficult sell for a lot of these states to turn around domestically and say, we're going to lessen our power. We're going to act in the interests of the global community to our own detriment. That's what the search is, really, in international relations and international diplomacy, for the middle ground. And that is why the real seminal importance of international law in all of this, because it's the one aspect of it that it's not perfect. It's not free from real politic, and it's not free from politicization, but the contamination is not felt as directly as we see in other areas.
Thank you. We've seen with a lot of the conflicts which have been occurring around the world now and within the past few years, states invoking national sovereignty to prevent human rights aid entering the country. Is that sort of an inevitable challenge that will be faced, or is there any way to provide human rights aid in the face of a state which is claiming to have ultimate power over what goes in and out of its country?
Here we're back to law. So now we're talking about, we're using a branch of international law called international humanitarian law. Okay, it's a law of armed conflict. It's the law that is there as the baseline protector for, principally for civilians, but also for those who are taking part in the conflict. This law has specific expectations in respect of the protection afforded to the population in the geographic area where conflict is taking place. That's simply it. The state or the non-state group should be providing for the needs of the people under the control that they're exercising. Now, we begin to run into difficulties when you have conflict which is so fluid, all-encompassing, that the very question of control begins to become difficulties. Who controls this area? Who controls this section? Who controls this suburb? Okay, that is challenging, but the obligation doesn't fade away just because of difficulties with questions of control. Where states can't and where the actors can't provide that humanitarian need themselves, then they should be allowing access to independent and impartial humanitarian organizations like the UN, organizations like the ICRC, that they should be providing access to them under their expectations under international humanitarian law. Now, there are exceptions. One aspect of international humanitarian law refers to military necessity. They're pretty narrow, and law itself fundamentally doesn't allow you to turn around and say, oh no, we're not going to provide any assistance to this population whatsoever.
No, I like how you brought up the conflict between like the US and Iran and Ukraine and Russia, and how there's so many different small or large conflicts going on all at one time. And it seems like they always just kind of fizzle out at the end, right? Like they just kind of come to a close and it's over, so to speak. But the issues still seem to prevail in political spheres. So do you think that there will ever be a norm of sorts when it comes to wars and conflicts appearing? Or do you think that there's always going to be some sort of need to have these rules of what to do written down?
So the simple explanation is that we have them. They're written down as well as being in customary international law. In terms of what takes place during an armed conflict, we have a glut of international law in international humanitarian law. International humanitarian law is not nice. It is a law which is predicated on the existence of circumstances where people are trying to end other people's lives. Is the dark corner of international law. It's pretty horrendous stuff, which allows for killing of in particular, enemy combatants. It's a corner of international law which also will allow for the death of those who are not participating in very constricted circumstances. They have norms. They have the principle of humanity, the principle of distinction between civilians and between combatants, the principle of proportionality in the extent to which attacks are used and weapons are used, and the principle of military necessity. And they're codified to a large extent. They also find themselves in customary international law. Now, customary international law is that body of law which is developed through state practice and through understanding that the practices forms a binding legal obligation. That's slightly more amorphous, but to the great credit of the International Committee of the Red Cross and Red Crescent, they've done wonderful work over decades trying to codify a lot of this into some type of text. I think that the problem that you're identifying is if we have these laws and if we have them written down and if we have norms and if we have principles, why on earth are we still seeing hospitals being bombed? Why are we seeing people waving white flags being shot and then people who are running to assist the people who have been shot thereafter being shot? And I'm not speaking about any particular conflict here, but how on earth can this be compliant with the law? And the reality is it's not. No, an awful lot of it is not. So I think the question is essentially, what's wrong with international humanitarian law in this? What's wrong with it? There are issues. First, there is a lack of adherence to it. We certainly see that. And it's not merely just in Israel-Palestine. It's not merely just Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It happens pervasively that it's not always complied with and it's not always adhered to. The second thing is that any law, whether it's written down or whether it's a custom, is subject to interpretation. And there are interpretative techniques that states can use in order to provide themselves and afford themselves considerable leeway. The principle of proportionality causes real difficulties with that. The very existence of the notion of collateral damage provides problems for this. The third thing is that states can be, and they have an inherent right to be, to a degree, secretive about some of their intelligence and some of their, in accordance with national security interests. And so when international humanitarian law may not be complied with, there is a problematic situation where you have to challenge the state on it or take the state at its word for the reasons behind the particular attack that has taken place. It's not a lack of codification and it's not a lack of norms that are the problems. The international community does try to go further. There are new laws coming into force all the time in respect of particular crimes. And you see judicial interpretations will advance these things. We have crimes of ecocide, which are being discussed at the moment. The international community and certainly subsections of it have spent the past 2 decades trying to really articulate and work out cyber attacks. And the role of cyber attacks in international law and how that correlates with international humanitarian law. And I'll have to say, as a human rights scholar, I'll plug this. International human rights law does not go away during an armed conflict. It exists. International human rights law exists at all times. If a state doesn't want to apply its human rights obligations, then it can issue something called a derogation, which is essentially to say we don't have the circumstances of a normal society here. And as a result, we have to lower the standards of our human rights that we're applying. They don't evaporate entirely. And human rights courts, European Court of Human Rights in particular, but the Inter-American Court as well, they are building a body of case law around the right to life during armed conflict and around things like the right to liberty and when you can detain somebody during an armed conflict. So the law is there, not always perfect, but the law is there. An awful lot of it is about adherence.
Do you think that more attention should be brought to that? Those types of laws that appear, like the stuff from the European Court of Human Rights, like, do you think maybe victims in places of war should be aware of those and use them if they can?
Yeah, it's a great question, Victoria. And I think it actually takes us back to the first question about, you know, optimism about the provisional measures decision. Mm-hmm. The reality is that these judgments, even ones which are progressive, forward-looking judgments, they only assist the individual in tomorrow's conflict, mm-hmm. insofar as the state has decided to adopt and adhere to the standards that are being set. The court process is ex post facto. It happens after mm-hmm. the event, okay? So there might be opportunities for rarely better reparations, but sometimes reparations, sometimes truth, sometimes finding out why a family member was killed. Sometimes these judgments will bring up around different practices in military codes of conduct. But by and large, they don't help the person in the war zone on that day. What helps them is politics, is diplomacy, responsible governance, and a view that every human life is sacred.
One final thing, a prominent international court which we haven't really mentioned yet is the International Criminal Court. Just like the International Court of Justice, which we mentioned right at the start, they have no power to force people indicted with their crimes, which are individuals charged of crimes of aggression, war crimes, crimes against humanity, are extradited to stand trial. And given this, to a pessimist, it might seem inevitable that trials by the ICC and then potential convictions will usually only occur after all the dust has settled and some change of power or natural end to events has resulted in the suspect being vulnerable to extradition, as was the case in Nuremberg and the ad hoc tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda. So I'd just like to ask your opinion if you'd say that perception of the ICC is accurate, and is this an unfortunate inevitability of trials of individuals for such crimes?
It's tough. The ICC was, on its creation, was heralded as a new form of international justice. It filled a huge vacuum in individual personal responsibility for these crimes. And its development over the time, particularly with the adoption of the crime of aggression, has strengthened. We're back to the requirement just to be realistic. The ICC, I think, is arguably a powerful deterrent against some individuals from issuing orders or committing certain acts, and that cannot be forgotten. You know, deterrence is a powerful tool in international law. It bears mentioning that the ICC is a body which requires resources, requires funding. It's already spread incredibly thin. It's got something like 17 different cases, ranging from, you know, Ukraine and Afghanistan. It's got Myanmar. There is ongoing investigations into events taking place on Palestinian territory. With limited budget and limited staff, it is limited in what it can achieve. It is important that it's there. By no stretch of the imagination should we look at the ICC and consider it to be toothless and powerless. There is something that we haven't mentioned, which is something called universal jurisdiction. Now, universal jurisdiction is where certain states, under their own domestic legislation, might decide that there are certain crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, where they could seek to arrest and try an individual. Now, states' jurisdiction is territorial, so it only really works if somebody turns up in your state. But if there is somebody where a state has issued an arrest warrant for them on the basis of universal jurisdiction in respect of war crimes or in respect of crimes against humanity, what that does is that restricts the ability for that individual to move. They don't go to Spain where they have an arrest warrant issued against them, okay? But now you're beginning to fall into situations where, well, they can't go to Spain, but they can't also go to some of the countries where Spain has an extradition treaty with. And so it can act as a deterrent as well. And it really critically important is that now we're talking about state resources. We're talking about state prosecutions. We're talking about sometimes the kind of state political pull and legitimacy with it as well, which can be powerful. What we're seeing in our discussion here as well, that we have to bear in mind just how patchwork some of these, much of international law is, in respect of trying to bring about cessation of harrowing instances, as well as trying to bring about some level of accountability and justice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the
conversation. Thanks for your time.